Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program. Hello there, and thanks for joining us on this Sunday night. And a very special evening we have for you. Later tonight, in an hour or so, we'll be joined by one of the world's most respected journalists in the world of religion. He's Clifford Longley, best known as a long-time editor of the respected international Catholic journal, The Tablet. Clifford Longley's career includes a stint as leader writer for the London Times in the long-ago days before Rupert Murdoch. And tonight, we take a look at issues facing the Catholic Church today. Also, Andrew West of the Religion and Ethics Report on Radio National will be along to chat about issues in the news. Noel Debien is back in the producer's chair and also in the studio with The Good Life. And this is The Inquisition. And in the chat room, Angela McCarthy. But first up, it's 20 years since Archbishop Peter Carnley of Perth took the then radical step of ordaining women to the Anglican priesthood in Australia. That long-fought battle will soon be the subject of a book, edited by Janet Scarfe and Elaine Lindsay. And in a few moments, they will join us, together with one of the first women to be ordained priest and now bishop, Barbara Darling. 2012 marks 20 years since women entered the Anglican priesthood in Australia. Yet still, the Anglican Diocese of Sydney remains firmly opposed. This week, St. James Church in the heart of Sydney hosted a celebratory reflection on women in the Australian Church. What was the message? Well, to help us with a little discernment, we're joined this evening by some who were there and others who have taken the time to interpret the impact on both women and the Church. It's a pleasure to welcome into the studios a former national president of the Movement for the Ordination of Women, Dr. Janet Scarfe, together with Dr. Elaine Lindsay, a previous editor of the Women Church Journal. And together they are co-editing a soon-to-be-published book, Preachers, Prophets and Heretics, Anglican Women's Ministry. And we're also joined on the telephone by one of those first ordained bishop, or consecrated bishop, I should say, but also one of those first ordained priests, Bishop Barbara Darling. Welcome to you all. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, John.
Janet Scarfe, let me come to you first. Can you give us an outline of the book, Preachers, Prophets and Heretics? Particularly, I notice that you're not giving us a simple little historical narrative here. You've actually chosen to wrestle with certain themes and strands. Which one struck you as particularly important and that you think should be addressed and have continuing relevance?
Well, it's hard to pick in a way, John, because there's so many threads through the book. One of them that really stands out to me, I think, is the way in which the debate in Australia was only one of a series of debates around the Anglican Communion, and yet it was conducted in a way quite often that made it appear as if the ordination of women had never, ever been raised as an issue anywhere, as if Australia was the first part of the Anglican Communion to discuss it. And I think when one reads Jane Shaw's first chapter in the book, which is like a magnificent overture to the collection of essays we've put together, one gets an appreciation that this debate within the Anglican Church has been going on for decades, way back earlier in the 20th century, and has certainly not just been confined to recent times or discussed for the first time.
And of course it wasn't the first, the Anglican Church wasn't the first to ordain women. A number of other more evangelically oriented Protestant churches dated back to even the 1860s. So the
Absolutely.
Issue had been an active part of the debate in the wider church for the best part of 100 years.
Absolutely, that's right. And that's one of the reasons why the word preachers is there in the title, because women were often preachers in the Methodist tradition, in the Unitarian tradition, and in other Protestant traditions. And we felt that that was a really important part of the background to the debate about the ordination of women as deacons, priests, and bishops within the Anglican Communion.
Elaine Lindsay, for you, what are some of the threads that struck you as significant as you were putting together this
I'll just go back to that comment on preachers, and one of the threads that did run through just about everything was it was really good when women were very modest, quiet, softly spoken, gentle, even though they didn't have the benefits of microphones and loudspeakers when they were preaching, but they weren't shrieking feminists. And that was sort of the complaint about women, that they were shrieking feminists right from the very beginning, and that was one of the accusations that was levelled at MOW members. It's been constant that women are meant to be very quiet and demure, and once they speak up, they're heretics.
It's hard to put ourselves back, even those 20 years of ordination and 30 years to the moment or to when the debate was festering, you could almost say, in Australia, because it was treated like that, particularly in the Sydney diocese, where there was so much opposition on theological grounds that had been held strongly through the character of the diocese and is still maintained. Is there evidence of a certain amount of provocation in the way that debate was held? That is, it was a deliberate stoking of the issues to make people advocating women's ordination appear to be on the radical fringe.
Well, I think when talking about the Diocese of Sydney, to me it's really important to preface anything by saying that for many years, the Diocese of Sydney, through Deaconess House, provided more opportunities for women to study theology and engage in paid professional ministry than any other diocese around the country. I think that's a really important point that's often missed, and although things have changed there, the diocese has made an enormous contribution to women's ministry in the past. In terms of provocation, I think it was always easy to satirise, lampoon, exaggerate some of the arguments that the movement for the ordination of women put forward in terms of why women should be priests. One splendid example, I think, of the misunderstanding is a cartoon that we found in the Sydney Morning Herald in 1977, when the General Synod debated for the first time the ordination of women. Church Scene, which was the national Anglican paper, found it a wonderful opportunity to boost circulation. So it took out an advertisement in the Sydney Morning Herald with a woman with long blonde hair looking quite seductive and provocative, wearing a beretta and some Latin in the background, "We are daughters of Eve." I'd never seen that cartoon until we discovered it. So if that was... I'd like to say that Church Scene's attitude and understanding did improve as the years went on. But the cartoons and the drawings and many of the comments at times seemed from within the church to be, I think, absurd. I think the community often understood this matter far more than the people within the church.
It's almost the cliched line, "I must hold this rigid position or all is lost," as the oak tree breaks in the wind and the reed bends. Is that the way the debate, in hindsight, Elaine, that you could characterise much of this debate?
I'm just thinking of the moratorium on the debate in the Sydney diocese. And I think that, yes, we're not going to debate it anymore. Well, you can all go away and we're going to happily sail along. We won't debate anymore, which is most unfortunate.
We're also joined in this discussion this evening by somebody who was there and continues to be there at the heart of the Anglican Church, indeed as a bishop, Bishop Barbara Darling. Barbara, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Fine. Good evening.
If you place yourself back then, what first led you to think, "I must be part of this discussion"?
A group of us had been studying theology as women in Melbourne in the 1970s, and we were able to think about what our calling might be. We weren't too sure in those days. The diocese wasn't too sure whether or not women should be made deaconesses, or we were eventually commissioned as trained women workers. And gradually, as the debate opened up, we felt we were able to be people considered for being deacons. And that happened in 1986, which is 26 years ago. And then we kept on hoping and working towards the ordination of women as priests. And as you said, this happened 20 years ago.
Just explain for us, for those many who listening who may not understand the arcane corners of this debate, you mentioned deacons and deaconesses.
Yes.
I take it then a deaconess is not simply a female deacon.
The deaconesses thought they were female deacons, but it was said by the church body that they were not actually ordained like the men, so they were a distinctive group.
So we even had subcategories of subcategories.
And they were in the first group in Melbourne. The deaconesses were then made deacons. Yes.
Reminds me of a line from Goethe. To see what with what discernment plane what things won't fit the human brain. It's Barbara, when you first set out on this, at what point did you feel called as a Christian, that you were called into the ordained ministry? Was this something that had been with you for a long time as a young person, or is it something stirred by the changing social circumstances of the period, of the 70s?
Yeah, I felt called to ministry. I wasn't quite sure what that ministry was. I didn't think at that time that it was possible for a woman to be ordained, so that was not what I felt God was calling me to then, but I felt called to some kind of full-time ministry. So I went along to selection conference and asked the diocese to see what they felt, and they weren't too sure at that stage what women should be called or what they should be doing. But Bishop Kay, the first woman bishop, felt that she should become a deaconess. So she went along the route of deaconess first.
And after that, you began to feel yourself that there was something here for you. At what point did you say, okay, I am going now to move towards full ordination?
I can remember I went for first selection in 1981, and then in the mid-1980s, Archbishop David Penman was our archbishop, and I went to see him about the possibility of maybe becoming a deaconess, feeling that was something that was accepted by the church, and he said, wait until after the next General Synod, because it may be possible for women to be deacons. And we both laughed at that, at the possibility, and then it did actually pass. And so in 1986, we were able to go forward for being deacons.
And you knew then that this would be potentially a path to full ordination as a priest.
We hoped it might be, yes. But we knew from what had happened at General Synod that it was not automatic, that we would have to go through the three stages, first for deacon, then for priest, and then for bishop after that.
How painful was this at the time for those going through it? And this is a question I'd ask all three of you, because from my memory, covering it as a journalist, not only was there a deal of anger and hilarity from time to time, but there were also a number of tears shed along the way, and indeed it seemed to cost a number of people, I wouldn't say it cost them their soul, but you could almost say it cost them something very close to their heart, in that a number of them are no longer in the church.
It was very painful for many people. Some stayed within the church and others felt they had to leave the church. Yes.
Mm. Janet?
For me, I never had a personal call to priesthood. It was about opportunities for women who felt called to have that call tested by the church, but not about me in particular. But it was a painful debate, because it seemed to me that the church was talking about all women. It wasn't just about some women who wished to be called. It was so revealing about the church's theology and practice and misogyny to all women, not only in the church, but also in the wider community.
Is this what it's almost some people treated it, and I can remember the debate, and this is reflecting on some women who were supporting women's ordination, as though it was shocking to them, as though it was a scandal. It was a scandal that belonged in the 19th century, in the full 19th century sense of the word scandal, that a woman should dare. Elaine?
A woman should dare to want to be a priest, or a woman...
A woman should dare to be like a man.
Just going back to that question of pain, when I was reading through all the contributions to this, I found a great deal of pain in these contributions. I think Janet differs slightly to me on that, but I found a great deal of pain reading through this and people remembering what it was like and almost opening up old wounds, at the way women were regarded as being not equal in the sight of God. And I think one of the things that came out of the seminar at St. James the other day was, with ordination, that women did finally feel equal in the eyes of God and equal to men, and how important that was. And that was being denied, why they couldn't be ordained.
You see, this not equal is not just in the church. In the way the debate was framed, it was women are not equal, full stop. Mm. It wasn't subclause, subclause. And that seemed to reflect, I recall at the seminar the other day, one person talking about having a relationship with a young man at the time, and she was theologically trained, but wasn't ordained in any sense, and he was theologically trained, and him saying to her in a potentially romantic situation, look, I enjoy this wonderful discussion with you as an intellectual equal, but I cannot have this discussion with you as a woman.
Mm.
Extraordinary mental conniptions that
well,
puts
John,
one in,
John,
you
asked at the beginning about the themes that had gone through.
Yes.
And I think one of the really powerful ones is this issue of women taking authority. In the ordination service, the bishop says to those who he is ordaining, or she is ordaining, take authority to preach the word of God, take authority to administer the sacraments. And I think the other side from the pain to me is the pleasure that many women found in being able to speak with authority, to speak with authenticity, to recognise that God has called them to do those things, and to do it with exuberance. And I think there's a very strong thread of that going through the book. It's, in a way, it's the kind of obverse side of the pain.
Mm. Barbara Darling, you must have talked with many women over the years who were there with you during that debate, or have since benefited from the struggle that was gone through it in those in the 80s and in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. What's your observation about the way that path has been received generally in the church?
I think in many dioceses it's been received with great joy, and for people to experience women both in parishes, in hospitals, in schools, prison chaplaincy, I think people have received the ministry of women and realise that we can bring a new dimension. We work alongside the men, and I think the women who are ordained more recently haven't been aware of the full story, and that was interesting. At the 20th anniversary celebrations in Perth earlier in March, some of the younger women said later that they just hadn't realised quite how much we'd been through 20 years ago. So I think it's been good for us to revisit and tell this story, and I look forward to reading the book that Elaine and Janet have put together, just so there's a record there of what's been happening the previous 20 years and the last 20 years.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio around Australia through Radio Australia and via the web to the world. We're talking about women in the priesthood, particularly the Anglican Church of Australia, recognising 20 years in 2012 since the first women were ordained priests in the Anglican Church in Australia. And there are some dioceses, notably led by Sydney, where that still cannot happen. So the debate still has perhaps a way to go. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can. 1300 800 222. Our guests are Dr. Janet Scarf and Dr. Elaine Lindsay, who are editing a book on women in ministry in Australia, tracing the history of the debate, and Bishop Barbara Darling, one of the first women to be elevated to the episcopacy in the Anglican Church of Australia. If you've questions to ask, if you were along the journey, if you think that this is a reflection of the way the women's movement has evolved in Australia, give us a call, 1300 800 222, 1300 800 222, from wherever you are in Australia. We'll pick up the tab. 1300 800 222, on Sunday nights on ABC Radio. Let me talk about one of the things, Barbara Darling, that has been the subject of a little discussion. Given that women have now been 20 years in the ministry, has it changed the church in the way that many said it optimistically would?
or pessimistically?
I think it's changed the church in the areas where women have been able to be priested. Yes, I think that we've brought a new dimension, and I think that people have realised that we now have both men and women who are able to lead and to be ordained, and that opens up the opportunities for more people to use their gifts in ministry.
Elaine?
I think a couple of the chapters we've got, one of the sections of the book is called Changing Metaphors, and this might not survive the publisher's editor, but actually the way the book is structured, context, controversy, changing metaphors and changing times, but yeah, the publisher may change it, but in the changing metaphors we're actually looking at the way liturgy has been refreshed by women like Janet Nelson, hymn writing, Elizabeth Smith, just the way images of God as female, inclusiveness, inclusive language, and it has certainly changed the face of the church where that sort of liturgy is in use.
Janet Scarfe.
Yes, if I might use the example of the ordination in Perth in 1992 compared with the Eucharist that was held there 20 years on. The Eucharist in 1992, for all the excitement, was very much a male service. It looked like an old men's club with men wearing heavy vestments that looked like embroidered carpets, using exclusive language, welcoming women into that environment. And it was a great occasion, but it was so sadly lacking in so many respects. The Eucharist that was held in whenever it was, 7th of March, at which Barbara preached, was to me utterly, utterly different. Now, I don't go to church these days, so to me it's 20 years of change, perhaps condensed into two events, but women presided, women, Barbara preached, the Bishop, Archbishop Hirft welcomed everybody, but the engagement of women in the service was entirely different. The language was different, the atmosphere was different, there was a lightness and an, I wouldn't say airiness, it's very hard to kind of find the language, but I thought it was quite awesome. And I think it had, I'm trying not to say a woman's touch, trying very hard not to say a woman's touch, but it did have a different atmosphere. I think the church looks different, which I think is enormously important to the community outside. The church sounds different. So even in church events, you don't have, say, at General Synod, you don't really have 230 men's voices shouting the hymns and the responses as if they're on a football field. It is slightly moderated. You know, the fact that there are nearly 70 women in General Synod now out of the 230 has to make some kind of difference. So I think, as an outsider now, the church does look and sound different. Now, the question that we ask in the book is that change real or is it simply cosmetic? And even 20 years on, I think perhaps it's too early to tell.
There is a debate, Barbara Darling, too, also about clericalisation, to use an awful technical term, that is the whole sacred order of ministry that once you become a priest you are admitted to, and that, the critics say, freezes you into a rigid structure in which all your focus becomes on the internal machinations of the church and your career is committed to being a good cleric because that's the way you earn promotion. And there was hopes that that would be altered and that the whole attitude towards the sacred ministry would in some ways be softened or influenced. Now, the question becomes, have women changed clericalisation or have they merely become clericalised women? You're one of those who's reached the high status of bishop and you've watched that journey. Do you have any observations? Of course, being subjective.
Yes. I think that there's a point that Muriel Porter made at the seminar on Thursday, that if you remain a layperson, you're not under the direct authority of the church in the same way. And so perhaps you can speak out differently than if you are a member of the church and within the church, where you do have accountability to your bishop or archbishop. So in a way, those of us who've entered the church have made these promises and vows, and so we're speaking within the church, but I think we are also able to bring our own perspectives as women, and we have brought some things that are new within the church in the last 20 years.
Elaine.
Yeah, there's a lovely quote in the book, actually. One of our women contributors was asking a bishop if male priests are as cheeky to their bishops as women priests are. No, said the male bishop, they've got careers to worry about.
Now, that is very telling. Janet, do you think that's a more than ironic comment?
It is an ironic comment. It's more than ironic, isn't it? But I think Muriel also made the point that with women ordained now, some lay women, feel that they're being excluded. And I think one of the really important contexts in which women found a sense of calling in the 1970s and early 80s was the expansion of lay ministry, so that the church had this kind of great interest and fascination with lay ministry in the 1970s, that it encouraged people to administer the chalice, to be involved in the intercessions, to do all sorts of things that the clergyman had just always done themselves. You know, it was their prerogative to do absolutely everything, even if it was their 14th service of the day. Many women found their way into theological study and eventually ordination through this opening up of ministry to people. Now, to lay men and to lay women. I can remember feeling this in the parish that I attended when I was an intercessor and I was a communion assistant and all sorts of things. And we had this truly wonderful woman who came, a deacon who came on her placement to us, and all of a sudden, those of us who had done the intercessions and been very involved in worship kind of found ourselves back in the pews while the while this truly wonderful woman deacon, who was fantastic, but stood there, you know, at the lectern and did what we used to do. I think it is a challenging thing, but it is something that that just has to be worked through. I'm sure there's more than enough work in the church for everybody.
You're on Sunday Night. Time to take your calls. 1-300-800-222. And of course, this issue extends beyond the Anglican Church. We are focused on the Anglican Church because it's 20 years this year since Anglican women were first ordained in Australia. But if you've got questions from the Catholic tradition or any of the other traditions in the Church, do give us a call. 1-300-800-222. Let's go to Ron in Longreach. Hello, Ron. Welcome. What would you like to say?
Good evening, John and ladies. What I'd like to say is that I think that the ordination of women was of paramount importance to the Church of England. Maybe not so much in the centres, but certainly in the rural areas, the Church of England could have closed the doors without the women.
Barbara Darling.
I agree. I think that having women to be able to be both within the metropolitan areas and in the country. Certainly women are willing to go to parishes there that maybe some men are not willing or able to do. So I think certainly women have added extra person power to the church.
Janet, do you have any sort of observations in the book about that, about the way rural ministry has been changed?
Not specifically that, but we certainly have some examples of women who were in professional ministry before ordination was possible, who were deaconesses and who ran parishes in remote areas. Mm. When I interviewed the many women who were in the first generation to be ordained, I came across a woman called June Armstrong, who was a deaconess and who for 25 years ran the parish of Wewak in Papua New Guinea in the 1960s and 1970s. Now, she'd been a man, she would have been a bishop.
Yes.
Because of her capacity, her administrative ability, her pastoral care, her leadership of the parish. But she wasn't. She was a deaconess and she was a nurse at the hospital, trained nurse at the hospital at the time. But People talk of Mary Kingston still, who was on King Island for many years as a deaconess. So sometimes, this is a slightly different twist on what you're asking, but I think that rural ministry or rural parishes sometimes gave women extraordinary opportunities to do things that they wouldn't have been able to do if they'd been in a larger city parish, perhaps.
Yes.
I was thinking Peter Sherlock, P-E-T-A, Peter Sherlock, says in one of her in her chapter about the difficulty of getting men, because she was aware that, you know, she's had a lot of women deacons and actually needed some male deacons, but how hard it was to get them to come out to regional areas and country areas. In the end, she gave up and just appointed people to positions.
And I think it was one of those things too, the experience that drove somebody like Dr. Patricia Brennan, who was for so many years a singular figure in the movement for the ordination of women, in that her experience working in Africa and seeing women taking on responsibilities, that even though they took on these responsibilities and were effective leaders, were never able, when they came back to Australia, to assume similar roles in Australia, because women couldn't occupy those sorts of positions. It was one of the things that was the spur in Patricia's experience, I think.
Yes, they could go back to flowers and tea making.
Yes,
yes, that's right. And but the book is dedicated to Patricia, who, as I think many of us know, died before the book came anywhere near completion, but it is dedicated to her, and she's a large presence in many of the chapters. She was an amazing woman, and I think the church would still be debating the ordination of women today had not Patricia managed to keep it in the forefront of public attention in the way that she did.
And risk occasionally being seen as that wild feminine ranter.
The heretic.
Well, the heretic. Yes. I mean, there's a quote in the book where Edmund Duke, who was a journalist at The Age at the time, interviewed her somewhere in 1985, just before a general synod meeting. And he quotes a clergyman as saying, oh, in the good old days, they burnt people like her. And you think, I mean, I sat next to a priest, I don't know that I'll mention his name, but who was the religion correspondent for The Australian, who was a priest, who, sitting 3 inches from me, explained to the audience that we were both addressing that the movement, the ordination of women, was a bunch of witches. So there were some kind of unfortunate things said. Sometimes you think perhaps they were speaking in jest, but no, dreadful things were said about Patricia, and awful things, generalisations were sometimes made about the movement for the ordination of women. I think the women themselves, I'm not sure how Barbara feels about this, but the women themselves who were seeking ordination were slightly more protected, in that it seemed to me that they were at worst described as misguided. They were not the ones who were the rampant feminists. The rampant feminists were allegedly the movement for the ordination of women, who were holding up banners and placards and generally embarrassing church episcopal processions marching into general synod, whereas the women themselves, many of whom actually didn't participate publicly in the debate, were relatively protected. How do you feel, Barbara, if I might ask Barbara?
I don't quite agree, in that many of us felt from within the church we needed to be able to try and argue and stand up and be counted from within. Certainly some of us were elected onto General Synod, and we were able to speak and just be there and be a presence to show people that we did exist and we were real. And I can remember standing up and speaking at several synods. So we tried to speak from within, whereas Movement for the Ordination of Women were speaking from without.
Was it tactical tension, that is, tensions between those within and those without on just how to proceed from time to time?
There may have been from time to time. I think some of the women who felt called to ordination were not as aggressively feminist as some of the others who were supporting that movement. And so there were some tensions at time, whereas at other times, I think those of us who are hoping to be ordained were very grateful that other people could speak up and say things. And this included men and men within the church, ordained men, as well as men who were supportive of the movement for ordination of women.
Yes, we should say there were a number of men, yes, priests, who really did put their careers on the line. On
they
this
certainly
debate,
did. Some of them refused to be made priests until their wives or spouses or, sorry, or wives or other people, other women, could be priested. So they waited.
Mm. We'll take another call from Mary in Dubbo. Hello, Mary. Thank you for joining us.
Good evening, John and everyone. I'm very interested in this topic, but I would just like to remind everyone that the Presbyterian Church was, I think, the first to ordain women in Australia in the 1970s. The Reverend Theodora Hobbs found herself in a very difficult position when the vote for the Uniting Church was taken, and she found herself in a parish that chose not to go into union, and the continuing Presbyterians do not have women priests. Mm. And of course, the Uniting Church has more than half, I would say, of our priests are now women. Mm.
The continuing Presbyterians did have women at first, and then they decided that they would not. I think that was a very sad situation.
How do you theologically dispriest someone? Was that ever sorted out properly?
I'm not quite sure if it's the same understanding of ordination. It would be interesting to follow that through.
I think Theodora continued to practice, didn't she? But, there were no more after her.
In very difficult situations.
Yes.
So it has been a case of steps forward and steps back for those who do want to see this through. The situation in the continuing Presbyterian Church is now that women are not ordained, is it? Is that the correct position now?
That's my understanding, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for joining us, Mary, very much.
Could I add something to Mary's comment? There was actually somebody before Theodora Hobbs. The Congregational Church ordained Winifred Keake in the 1920s in Adelaide. She was probably the first. But the if we're talking about preachers, the first was Martha Tucker, who was at the Unitarian Church in East Melbourne, and she was supposed to be the first woman preacher in the British Commonwealth. She was written, or the British Empire, I'm sorry, the British Empire. She was written up as 1870s?
1873, I've actually got it in front of me here.
It's 1873. And before she was appointed to the Unitarian Church, her brother, who was a notable Victorian, eminent Victorian, was a member of that congregation, and he used to preach, but she used to write all his sermons.
And if you go back into the United States experience, they've had women preaching in that role. Most famously, I think, Phoebe Palmer, who used to go around with her husband, Dr. Palmer, and he would allow his wife to take the pulpit.
Yes. The great Maud Royden came to Australia in 1928. She was a well-known English preacher who did keenly want to be ordained in the Church of England and obviously couldn't, but she became very well known as a preacher, and she travelled the world. She did a wonderful world tour in 1928, and she came to Australia. She preached in two Anglican, as we call them now, churches. She preached at St Mark's Darling Point in Sydney, and she preached in St Peter's Cathedral. And when she was written up as in the press as being the first woman to preach, a number of people wrote in and said, no, there were others. Other vicars' wives had preached in all sorts of places. So it was quite interesting. The police had to be called to turn away or to control the crowds, the 2,000 people who turned up to hear her at Pitt Street Congregational Church in 1928. Mm. She was quite something. She smoked, flew everywhere and drove a car.
This debate has to be seen in the context of the wider feminist debate, does it not? If you go back into the 1880s, you have the temperance movement, the womb movement for women to get some democratic recognition, constitutional recognition, recognition at law. You begin to have the Salvation Army with women preachers as part of their ordained structure from the 1880s. There was a real firm, in the Anglican Church, of course, you had Josephine Butler and people like this. There was a real ferment around that time, was there not? Janet Scarfe.
Yes, there was. But the 1970s, I mean, the debate started really gathered momentum in the 1970s, which was, of course...
I might have misspoke then. I was alluding to that ferment in the 1880s.
Oh, sorry.
And that early first feminist movement. Elaine, you were probably... I'm
agreeing with you, John.
That there was generally a social ferment which led to that first wave of women. I guess what I'm going to is how much of that first early feminism in the 1880s leading to women getting the vote or that sort of thing came out of the churches.
Quite a lot of it did. Muriel Porter's done some work on this, and I think Peter Sherlock has too, and they've said that the first early feminists, many of them came out of the women's Christian temperance movement and out of the Christian background, the Christian churches.
Yes. So it's something that you can't divorce from its social context. As Janet, you're saying, even in the 1970s with that second wave feminism, there is an influence both ways there. Yes,
I think that's true. One of the arguments that I found so telling when I was so involved in this 20 years ago was a book I read about the admission of women to university and the debates that went on about that. And it seemed to me that there were so many parallels between that and the debate about whether or not women could be ordained. It was extraordinary. For example, women at the University of Edinburgh, five women wanted to study medicine, and the university said, no, they couldn't possibly study medicine. The university was no place for women. There'd never been any women at a university since the first universities like Bologna were founded. Universidom was kind of for men. Eventually they relented and said the women could study medicine if they found faculty members who would teach them off the premises. So they studied medicine courtesy of some kind professors. The university eventually said, after much petitioning and debate by the petitioning by the women, the university said, all right, you can study with the men, but you may not sit for the exams. That is, you can't have the qualification. They pressured on that, and eventually the university said, that's all right, you can sit for the exams, but you can't win a university medal, because when one woman topped the year, she would have been entitled to the medal, and they said that. And I guess the point I'm making, probably badly, is that it's this incremental creep and this grudging resentment on the part of the authorities to give any leeway. And I think that's, I suppose when MOW was, or those pressing for the ordination of women did seem like shrieking feminists, or did seem argumentative, or did seem unsatisfied with every tiny drop of change, it was with those kind of stories in mind that every point had to be argued, every concession that was made seemed ungenerously given. I think it was a very difficult time in that sense.
It makes you think and reflect again that there's something, it's not just simple theology here, there's something deeply psychosocial about it as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It sort of reflects, I think, on the concept of priesthood as authority over people, whereas some of the women who are writing for us are talking about priesthood as service, which is an entirely different concept of priesthood and much healthier, I think.
Some would argue more New Testament.
Yes.
Let's take another call. Mary Matthews in Dubbo. Thank you for that, Mary. Let's go to Tilly in Kyneton in Victoria. Hello,
yes.
Tilly. Welcome. What would you like to say?
Yes. Hello, John. And thank you for the great program. All this conversation about women wanting to be ordained, it's in the Protestant church. Does the Protestant church have something similar as nuns?
Well, now, there's an interesting observation. Do Protestant traditions allow for things like a sisterhood, the nuns, a nunnery?
We have to say Janet and I both went to a Sisters of the Church school.
Oh, really?
An Anglican order.
Because the Anglican Church, in its break from Rome, did preserve the tradition of orders for women.
They came back more in the 19th century with the movement that happened with the Oxford movement. And in Australia, we've got several different communities. And at the seminar on Thursday, we heard particularly about the Sisters of the Church, Sisters of the Community of the Holy Name, and Society of Sacred Advent, three different orders in Queensland, New South Wales and Melbourne, but they went to other places as well.
So the question that follows, probably in Tilly's mind, is, well, why isn't this an adequate substitute for the priesthood? Is it a legitimate alternative? What's the big deal, Barbara Darling?
some of the women who are sisters, who are nuns, are also priests these days in two of those three orders. I'm not sure about the third. I think it's very different. I think if you look at the men also have choices of being priests or of being in communities as well. And it's a different kind of community living. And that has changed, again, over the years. But I feel people feel called to one or the other and not necessarily to both.
And, of course, we should acknowledge that a priesthood confers a whole range of opportunities on people for sorts of ministries in the church that simply being a member of a religious community doesn't.
That's right. Yeah.
There are also the vows of poverty, chastity and obedience, which are taken by members of religious communities, possibly with different names, but which are not taken by people who are ordained.
Bruce in WA is on the line. Hello, Bruce. Welcome.
Hi, John. I think we're met at World Council of Churches occasions, but no worries. I have a problem that we keep talking about the church, and as a consequence, my wife, when she was going to do a marriage, someone through their marriage preparation, was asked before while the debate was in WA, but you can't be legal. Women are not ordained. And the problem I have is the debate drops the word Anglican out of it. So it's the whole assumption is, when people are listening not carefully, is that it's only 20 years since women have been ordained. As you said, of course, the Congregationalists were back in the 20s, so the Methodists beat the Presbyterians, and the Uniting Church, they all had to have women ordained before they could come to union, because they couldn't have different rules for different
different traditions, yes.
We came into union, and that's partly what happened when the Presbyterians who stayed out. When they reversed it, they did not de-ordain anyone. All they did was, we will ordain no more.
Yes, so those who were ordained, I guess, would have felt the hurt of being denied access to the things they could have done legally or legitimately previously. They just had to sit and cop it.
No, I think they maintained all their, but they just would not ordain anymore.
Right.
It must make those women feel as though they were inadequate, that the church didn't want any more women priests.
But the interesting thing in the Uniting Church is that we've had one male, one female, non-ordained, leading the church, but all the other leaders have only been males. All the other leaders who have been all ordained have only been males. So we've yet to have I guess, the equivalent to a bishop.
Well, there you go. There's things to look forward to yet. Now, we're going to have to wind up this conversation in a moment or two. But let me ask one other thing, just quickly. You've got a brief minute to go around. The future. The Church of England in England is now debating women bishops. We've had Barbara, you're one of those women who've become a bishop in Australia. What's your view? Is this debate going to split the Anglican Church worldwide?
I hope it's not going to. There are some people who are opposed, and what the church in England is trying to do is to work out a way forward. Here in Australia, there are a very small minority who are opposed to that. So far, we've been able to coexist. I hope that it will go ahead in England next year, they're hoping. For us, I think we still have a way to go. The three of us who are now consecrated bishops are all assistant bishops in the diocese. We're not actual bishops who are in charge of diocese. And I think that it will be great when we have someone who is able to be a diocesan bishop, who is a woman.
Janet Scarf, about 30 seconds.
My hope is that the church as an institution doesn't become complacent about the fact that women have been ordained, and that it is very aware that in some locations there is quite a backlash going on about not only women being ordained, but inclusive language and wider theological understandings of the role of women. So I hope that doesn't happen.
Beware the backlash. Elaine Lindsay, yes. We've run out of time.
Oh, look, I'm just going to say it's 10 years anniversary of the ordination of Catholic women on the Danube River this year.
Beware. They are coming. The Catholic Church, that's another debate on Sunday night. This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.